I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. This is the second of my interviews with the conspiracy theory wing of the Christian right, in this case with Philip Collins, an author of a book about the attempt by a trans-historical, trans-cultural, global conspiracy of oligarchs to create a socialist world government. This community is at least as big and influential as the secular techno-progressives that my show is aimed at, and they are also probably much better armed. Know thy critics, I say, especially when they suspect you of being the spawn of demonic aliens in league with the socialist Jewish bankers conspiracy that controls the Bush administration. So, on to the interview. We're speaking today with Philip Collins. Philip is about to complete his degree at Wright State University. He's studied philosophy, religion, classical literature, written many articles for various journals, Paranoia Magazine, The News with Views, Biped. His work, he has a number of very interesting articles at conspiracyarchive.com, and he's the author of a large tome of history, a couple steps outside of the mainstream perspective, called The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an examination of epistemic autocracy from the 19th to the 21st century. Well, welcome, Philip.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You first came to my attention, I think, with the essay on Luciferianism, which is one of the central themes of the Ascendancy book, where you mentioned me and a couple of my buddies as being Luciferians. And so let's start there. This Luciferian idea seems to be a central one of yours, the notion that there is a central ideological theme running through ruling class religions, through the oligarchical ideologies throughout history, but especially since the Enlightenment.
Certainly.
And that the idea of human enhancement and the creation of human, at least the control of human characteristics, which you also see as part of a control ideology and not just an enhancement ideology, but at least this has been a central theme of that. Is that a correct characterization of the Luciferianism idea?
To a certain extent. Really, Luciferianism, if you want its modern incarnation, it's really a secular humanism. But the idea, the central theme of Luciferianism is that man is gradually evolving towards apotheosis, that is, he's becoming a god. And Lucifer, the character of Lucifer, whether you accept him as a literal metaphysical entity or whether you want to just acknowledge him as part of a Christian myth, to the Luciferian, Lucifer is a metaphor for the human condition and for humanity itself. He represents the cognitive powers of man as being one of the chief facilitators of humanity's salvation. The doctrine that they adhere to is more or less a Gnostic one. It's a Gnostic doctrine of self-salvation. And this idea was very popular during the Enlightenment, as you previously mentioned, the idea that it was a man working with his own cognitive powers and pretty much applying the science of progress and ongoing progress to the human condition in order to propel humanity beyond its present state and into a post-human state, to reiterate the Nietzschean mantra, man is something to be overcome. And Lucifer, for the Luciferian, is not a literal metaphysical entity. In fact, Luciferianism, I characterize it as a self-eviscerating belief system, because it pretty much jettisons all of its metaphysical contents and reduces most of it to allegory for mainly for the human condition and for humanity's potential to become something else, something post-human, if you will, beyond what humanity presently is, and that is in essence a god.
You also mentioned Gnosticism and your writings. You've written an essay at the Conspiracy website where you describe the revival of Gnosticism and transhumanism as being part of the revival of Gnosticism. There are many different definitions of what Gnosticism is, and especially now with the
Da Vinci Code.
The Da Vinci Code that's come out that's very popular. There's been a revival of interest in that. But what's your definition of Gnosticism?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, it's become a very elastic appellation, especially after the Enlightenment. You had kind of the rise of a secular Gnosticism, where the eschaton of heaven and hell was pretty much transplanted here on this ontological plane of the physical universe, and essentially Marxist and fascist, communist, what have you, were tantamount to secular Gnostics, basically relocating all those Gnostic concepts on this worldly plane. Really, I would characterize Gnosticism again. It very closely resembles the paradigmatic character of the Luciferian belief system. Now, that's not to say that every Gnostic will be a Luciferian, but they're certainly conceptually predisposed to that sort of thinking, because the overall idea, again, is this governing precept of self-salvation, that humanity through gnosis, which, again, is basically the cognitive powers of man, will basically procure his own salvation. And there's no need for a transcendent God outside of this ontological plane of existence to redeem him. And essentially, I think that would pretty much sum up Gnosticism as the doctrine of self-salvation, and also the mandate to immanentize the eschaton, as Gnostic doctrine puts it, or to put it in more layman's terms, to create heaven on earth, to basically take this irredeemable physical world and transform it through the transformation of man's sensate being, transform this irredeemable physical realm into basically a worldly paradise.
Now, you start off your book, Ascendancy of Scientific Dictatorship, with a straightforward acknowledgement that your work is going to be in the conspiracy literature. It's going to be an argument for conspiracy throughout history.
Sure.
And you acknowledge some of the critiques and complaints that people have about conspiracy theory, such as the notion that there's a that there's a unity among the conspiracies, that all of the oligarchs have all shared exactly the same ideology and exactly the same game plan.
Right.
You dismiss that. You say that's not what we're talking about here. There's competing oligarchical ambitions that undercut one another, and there's many different ideologies among these oligarchical ambitions, but they all have some common features.
Right. Yeah, there's a continuity of thought there. It's typically the same theme. To give you an example, for instance, neoconservatism, which pretty much now dominates the American presidency, the current administration, and is pretty much leading American foreign policy. Neoconservatism is, in and of itself, really a form of Gnosticism. The idea of a Pax Americana, that is a world peace, this unilaterally initiated world government, basically reiterates the Gnostic mandate to immanentize the eschaton. It is a bit different from, say, the variety of world government that the architects of the United Nations might have had in mind. Many of the people who were involved in the organization of the United Nations were initially committed to a world government dominated by Britain. Many of them were old line Anglophiles coming out of the John Ruskin's Cecil Rhodes school of elitism. And as their idea was carried on by the many other individuals who became involved in the United Nations, it became more of a Pax Universalis, or a world government governed by this omnipotent world body, the United Nations, which was dislodged from all the nation states of the world, and in fact presided over them and had overall primacy. So, as you can see, it's a unifying theme, a unifying continuity of thought, but it's not the same thing. People have got to dislodge their brains from this ridiculous James Bond depiction of the conspiracy as being some sort of organization like Spectre, with Blofeld there stroking a cat and he's coordinating all of the moves. That's not how it works. This is a relatively loose network of competing interests that are nonetheless committed to a relatively similar vision. And that vision is of a one-world socialist totalitarian government. The same mistake was made during the post-World War II era. Many people believing that that they were opposing fascism, for instance, became communist. Well, this is a Hegelian dialectic. Fascism and communism are really ideological kissing cousins.
Okay, hold on one second, because sure. I think for many of my listeners, it comes as a surprise for someone who seems to be a conservative Christian and an opponent of socialism and many things that I support, as a matter of fact, world government, for instance. And yet you also would connect then the Bush administration and neoconservatism as being a part of a conspiracy to create world socialist government. I mean,
I'm sure
that this comes up often, because it would seem like this is an administration that's supported by conservative Christians. And
oh, sure.
Is a militant opponent of any move in the direction of world socialist government.
Well, it would appear so. However, for instance, the founding father, the godfather of neoconservatism, Irving Kristol, was himself a Trotskyist, and said of his Trotskyist past that he had not a single regret. The idea of this global democratic revolution, which you've consistently heard Bush mention, really reiterates the Trotskyist strategy of the Fourth International. In fact, during one of his speeches, George Bush made a very conspicuous literary allusion. He mentioned quote unquote fire in the minds of men. And this is an allusion to Dostoevsky, an old Dostoevsky novel, and Dostoevsky used the fire in the minds of men, that statement, to characterize the old radical socialist revolutionaries of his time, the people who constituted what James H. Billington, a librarian of Congress, called the Promethean faith. And again, that harkens back to the older idea, because of course Prometheus basically bequeathed the light of knowledge unto man. Again, you have there the idea of man's cognitive powers acting as the chief facilitators of his salvation and of his apotheosis again. And so, see, it's really the same continuity of thought, but on the surface, cosmetically, it's not always going to appear to be the same. And really, what is the difference? If America is ruling the world, and we call it an empire, or if the United Nations, for instance, is ruling the world, and we call it a multinational coalition, there's really very little difference between the two. I mean, both would involve basically the dismantling of national sovereignty, some serious serious limitations to personal freedom, some seriously totalitarian measures being implemented. So really, there's very little difference. It's the same continuity of thought there.
I'm speaking with Philip Collins. He's the author, with his brother Paul Collins, of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an Examination of Epistemic Autocracy from the 19th to the 21st Century. This is Dr. J, and you're listening to Change Surfer Radio. Point. I was trying to explain your book to my wife, who is a good interlocutor for this kind of thing, because she doesn't pay much attention to these particular debates.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue of epistemic autocracy, I think I may have mischaracterized it, but here's I'm going to give a stab at it.
Sure.
Your argument, along with Foucault, is that part of the machinery of power, part of the machinery of power, is the control of the way people perceive reality, ways that they understand that it's legitimate to find things out, their epistemologies, and that the scientific autocracy has established certain rules of knowledge which say you have to prove things this way and not other ways, and that excludes us from finding out about the kinds of conspiracy that you're arguing for. Now, the way I explained it to my wife was, the conspiracy tells us that we have to prove that it exists with scientific methods, and since they control the scientific methods, we can't prove the conspiracy exists, ergo, we don't see the conspiracy. Is that a correct way of characterizing the idea of epistemic autocracy?
Yes, to a certain extent, yes. Now, they basically, the elite, they of course finance a good many of these institutionally accredited scientists and what have you. That's not to say that every scientist is a member of the conspiracy, and that's not to say that all modern science is, you know, some malevolent force. And I want to caution people out there. I'm not some anti-technological dystopian. Technology and science have their legitimate place and certainly can enhance the human condition and should be used for enhancing the human condition and the abatement of suffering. The problem is, though, is with, for instance, contemporary science. Ever since it came under the prominence of the radical Baconians of the British Royal Society, which was largely a Masonic institute, ironically, and the Freemasonry being a retainer of the ancient Mesopotamian mystery religions. Ever since it came under their dominance, and since then, scientists have largely worked within the parameters of radical empiricism. And basically, radical empiricism is the epistemological position holding that knowledge is derived exclusively from the senses. Now, ironically, this doctrine of sense certainty is no less mystical in character than its religious progenitors. And in fact, if you carry empiricism to its radical ends, to its logical conclusions, really, reality becomes tantamount to an amorphous hologram, a kind of a gelatinous amalgam of impressions and perceptions. And that becomes something that that the scientists, that the people who comprise the epistemic autocracy believe they can pretty much etch whatever they want to into it, like a tabula rasa of sorts. But that's mainly the problem with modern science. And of course, working under the yoke of radical empiricism and materialism and other epistemologies, which basically hold the primacy of this ontological plane of the physical universe, one really doesn't have any room for suprasensible entities, for the incorporeal. One, of course, really doesn't have room for God. And, of course, that's very philosophically expedient for the Luciferian core of the conspiracy, because there really would be no God for them. There's no transcendent God, certainly none that man is answerable to or needs to turn to for salvation. And, in fact, he is on his way to becoming God. And that's the problem. And, of course, anybody who anybody who believes themselves to be God can then set about rationalizing their own personal self-interest, and that becomes a very ethical slippery slope, so to speak, and that's when you have things like the Holocaust. In fact, Adolf Hitler once said, man is becoming God. That's a simple fact.
Okay, wait. Most of the violence until the 20th century, I mean, you could even argue that the violence of fascism was a religious form of violence, because
sure,
there were religious beliefs involved in fascism, but most of the violence throughout human history has been religiously, at least had a religious gloss to it.
Yes, and I would be compelled to agree with you, but what I'm saying is basically that this new, the new epistemology and the new dominant scientific paradigm is no less religious in character. That's why, sociologically speaking, most of the atheists, ostensibly atheistic movements throughout the 20th century, like communism, have behaved like religions. Again, one could characterize the early socialist revolutionaries, revolutionaries of Lenin's day and age, as basically secular Gnostics. The only real difference between them and their old Gnostic progenitors was that they basically relocated all of those concepts on this ontological plane of existence.
I think one of the problems that most people would have with the conspiratorial frame of mind, and in particular with the kind of analysis that you articulate, is that if you make your theme, your thread that connects these conspiracies as simple and as short as the idea that that we can improve things here on Earth, then all kinds of people get connected to that.
Sure, sure.
And one of the kinds of ramifications of that would be, for instance, that certain kinds of theological, even conservative Christian theological worldviews, like dominionism, might in fact be a part of that. Because
right,
dominionism argues that it's a Christian's responsibility to establish heaven on earth before Jesus comes back.
Right. My main concern is not so much the enhancement of the human condition and the abatement of human suffering. Believe me, for instance, tomorrow, if somebody were to develop a bionic eye, I would probably be the first person in line to get one, because I have a prosthetic left eye. I lost my eye as an infant, and I have no qualms with that. I have no qualms with trying to basically allay human suffering and enhance the human condition as much as possible. What I do have problems with, though, is this overall anthropocentric hubris that we're going to create a utopia, and utopian thinking is extremely problematic. Of course, as you know, Thomas More, he used the word utopia. It basically meant nowhere. And I think that's very, very significant, because utopia really could manifest itself nowhere, because one man's utopia might be another man's dystopia, because there's conflicting ideas on what would constitute utopia. Some people say, well, it would require a scheme of wealth redistribution. Well, we know that doesn't work, because wealth redistribution leads to economic stultification. Eventually, the incentive to work is gone, because everybody's wealth is confiscated before, you know, they can even enjoy the fruits of it. And of course, there's a question as to whether or not that's even a benevolent or altruistic system of economics, because wealth confiscation basically is tantamount to theft. And
Philip, what do you make of the fact that the people with the longest life expectancies and the people who appear to be the happiest in the world are people in Northern Europe, who, you know, they have a great deal of wealth equality compared to the United States?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't you find the Northern European example a little bit giving you pause, that they're both secular, egalitarian, and happy and healthy?
I'm sure that there's a whole lot of other factors that play into that, though. A good bit of it sounds to me like it's also largely attributable, say, to dietary practices. You don't have people injecting growth hormones and garbage like that into the livestock and what have you. Most of their agriculture is you know, organic, and there's not much in the way of these huge corporate agro farms where they place, you know, steroids and all sorts of other funky stuff in the soil to make these plants shoot up like, you know, lightning rods.
Philip, did you know that the state with the lowest rate of divorce in the United States is Massachusetts?
No, I did not.
And there's a positive correlation between church going and divorce rates throughout the United States. I mean, I'm not trying to just beat you over the head with sociological statistics.
Sure, sure.
But it seems that the worldview that you articulate, you know, there's no positive program on the other side that is, to me, convincing. Has there ever been a regime, a country, a state, town, that instantiated the kind of religio-political worldview that you would like to see actually manifested on planet Earth?
Actually, I would concur with you on that. There doesn't seem to be any sort of really favorable alternative, with the exception of Americanism in its inception. The reason being is because America wasn't a theocracy. It certainly wasn't
the founders of this country were Unitarians.
Yes, they were, but the form of government that they founded was more so theocentric. It wasn't theocratic. You could practice whatever religion you desired to practice, but it was theocentric in that it acknowledged the existence of a creator, and that because man is basically reliant and dependent upon this creator, he's also dependent and reliant upon the morals and the values and the principles that this creator embodies. And so because those morals, values, and principles act as the overarching law of the land, man can continue to live free, and man can continue to you know, live as he sees fit within these particular parameters. And now, of course, outside of those parameters, like, for instance, when you get into the realm of thou shalt not murder, then, of course, you're going to have problems. And
well,
that,
if we could return to the Christianism of Thomas Jefferson, who
sure.
edited the New Testament, all the supernatural elements out of the New Testament,
right.
and issued his own version of the New Testament, I'd be
right.
perfectly content with living under that kind of regime. I've been speaking with Philip Collins. He's a student at Wright State University, about to finish his degree there. He's the author of an enormous study of history and thought called The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an Examination of Epistemic Autocracy from the 19th to the 21st Century. And actually, it goes all the way back to what, 500 BC? It's not just the 19th and 21st century.
Right. It's just the 19th century where you see the edification of this basic overall transmogrification of the basically the ruling machinations, how the oligarchs basically ruled humanity.
You can read much more of Philip's work at conspiracyarchive.com, and there are many podcasts out there where you can hear him trip the phrase immunitizing the eschaton right off his tongue, just like it's a normal phrase that you use every day.
That's good practice.
Philip, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@IEET.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at IEET.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.